Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Dear friends, we've come up a long ways, you might say, in these 2.5 days of meditation, going through the life and death process. And, you know, the great question is how to integrate and incorporate, you know, the practice of mindfulness, and of course the practice of sila, samadhi, and panya, the noble eightfold path, into the daily life. But first of all, I want to finish a few remarks on the nature of consciousness and the two levels of the meaning of death. Now, as we understand in the Buddhist teaching, the process of the five aggregates that's arising and vanishing moment by moment, and the six senses, the six sense stimulations of contact that are arising, moment by moment, one after the other, you know, that's the process of anicca. And to develop the mind, to develop our mindfulness and concentration to such a degree that we can clearly see each of those moments very clearly, almost like flash bulbs going off, the arising of consciousness when the mind is in a deep state of concentration and mindfulness is almost like a flash bulb going off each moment of hearing, seeing, tasting, smelling, touching, and thinking. And the simile of a motion picture reel of film is quite appropriate in sort of describing the phenomenon of the consciousness, especially of the ignorant-dominated, ego-dominated consciousness, is like the roll of film. So you all know the old kind of films, not the digital ones, you know, the old film rolls, which were made up of many individual frames. You know, and it took many hundreds of frames to see a person, you know, just move their arm up and down. And if you looked at only one frame, it wouldn't mean much. You wouldn't see any action there. You wouldn't, you know, be able to really see, know anything about it. But only when they're run quickly through the projector with the light, then the illusion of some fluid flowing action or scene, some drama, appears on the screen. But if you go back and inspect the roll of film, all you see is individual frames. And so all the, you know, the life and melodrama that might have been happening on the screen, basically it's an illusion. But basically that is what's occurring actually in our mind from moment to moment. But we don't see the spaces in between those moments because our consciousness is dull. It's very slow. It's not been trained to a high degree, to a high frequency. It's at a very low frequency. And so the mind gets caught and clings to these objects because they're run together, and we take it to be real. And even the sense of I arises with each of those moments of hearing, seeing, tasting, smelling, touching, and thinking. The sense of I, which is the sakkaya ditti, or the mana, it clings to that consciousness like a kudella. You know kudella, right? It attaches, you know, and sucks your blood. So, because of avidya or moha, and that's the job of mara, it keeps arising and clinging to the consciousness. So we think it is I that am doing these things. Because again, they're all run together. And desire and the ego are like two sides of a coin. You can't have one without the other. And that's why anatta and the second noble truth of ignorance and craving is the source of suffering are very much intimately connected. And even though the second noble truth says that craving is the source of suffering, it's actually ignorance. It's because we don't know the truth that we've allowed our mind to get caught up in craving and aversion. And so it's the craving that causes us to do kamma, but really the I behind it is what's generating the craving, because it's the I that wants to enjoy, or the I that wants to get away. So as long as this illusion is arising, then ignorance and the production of kamma continues. And therefore the whole round of the paticca-samuppada, craving, grasping, becoming, birth, and suffering, and then the rebirth again. So, but each of those moments is a birth and a death. Each moment, you know, a moment of hearing arises and vanishes, a moment of seeing, a moment of the other senses. And that's the real birth and death from moment to moment. And in the practice of insight meditation, when you speed up the rate of noting, what I call the trick of vipassana is that we speed up the rate of noting. So that in the anicca sanya, you're training the mind to just note and release, note and release, note and release. Just like seeing each of the pictures on a film, but you don't cling to that. So a moment of feeling, a moment of the in-breath, a moment of hearing, a moment of out-breath, a moment of an itch, a moment of an in-breath. You let them alternate. You let them alternate between the body and hearing, because then the mind gets confused. It can't connect the dots. If you're feeling lots of body sensations in a row, then the clinging is there, the perception is there. Oh, that's my body. That's a pain in my leg. That's my this, that's my that. But when you're interspersing it with moments of hearing, and if you just listen to sound, you say, oh, what a nice little tweety bird. Oh, that's somebody talking. I don't like that person. Because we're clinging to these moments and threading them together to allow the mental stories to arise in our mind. And we get attached to it. So the secret in Anicca Sanya is to gradually open up and, you know, because the body is going on, there's always sounds going on, and to let them alternate. And the mind, it can't form any story about the body or hearing because the dots are being disconnected. It's like the child's coloring book. You know, the book has many dots on it. And you look at the page of the book, you can't really make out what it's going to be. But you give the child or anybody a crayon, and with a red one they connect certain dots, with a green one they connect certain dots, and bingo, Mickey Mouse, or Donald Duck, or whatever. But it's because they connected the dots. The dots by themselves don't mean anything. So there's a dot of body feeling, there's a dot of hearing, there's a dot of a thought, there's another dot of a body feeling, a dot of hearing, maybe two or three dots of the body but in different places, you know, one here, one there, and a sound coming from this ear, a sound coming from that ear, and the mind gets disoriented. That means that it doesn't know what stories to create. And this is how you throw a wrench into the conditioned mental process. How you outsmart the Mara. See, Mara is banking on your delusion. But the Buddha is smarter. That's why the Buddha created this Anicca Sanya, you know, the Vipassana meditation. That you're outfoxing the mind. You're tricking the mind out of itself. By speeding up the rate of perception. Of course, it takes a good degree of concentration and mindfulness to do that. But nevertheless, it can be done. So you gradually speed up the rate of perception until it builds up very fast. You know, I mentioned yesterday in one of the guided meditations, so it looks like the popcorn, just where popcorn is, you know, popping in a machine, and hundreds of them pop. And there's just moments of, you know, hearing, seeing, tasting, smelling, touching, and thinking. But the mind can't connect any dots, and so Sanya falls away. Sanya means the creation of mental stories and pictures. A nice little picture of, you see, or a certain, you know, shape, and you're looking at this, you're clinging to that, and the mind is, you know, there's a monk there. Because of various marks, you know, shaved head, this color. But that's Sanya, because the mind is focusing on it. So anyway, in the Vipassana, you're disconnecting the dots, the lines, and just seeing the scattered dots, and the mind can't create the pictures. So the mind can't cling, because it's the Sanya, the memory of the object, that brings in the past or future, brings in the desire or the aversion or the jealousy or the envy or anger. But without the pictures, those sankharas get suspended. And the mind opens up and expands. Normally it's contracted on this object. Me meditating, looking out these eyeballs. Oh, that sound! And the mind's very shrunken. It's called a shrunken mind. Or especially when it, you know, falls asleep. But in Vipassana, you wake it up, and the way to wake it up is by listening to more and more things, and build up that speed of perception. And then also the sense of self depends on the object. As I mentioned, the ego and desire are like two sides of a coin. When there's no objects to desire, then that's the food for the ego. It's like taking the food away from the ego. And it starts to kind of back off and fade away. And if you can maintain that long enough, then there'll be a total break in the conditioned mind, and the mind will lapse into its unconditioned state. And that's when you experience magga, or, you know, like the path moments. When you completely experience that unborn state of the mind, the unconditioned state of the mind, the amata dhamma. Even if it's just for a very brief moment, it's very powerful and shakes you to the roots. And of course it destroys the three fetters of sakkaya ditti and doubts and attachment to rites and rituals. But anyway, that moment of, you know, experiencing the unconditioned is a moment of ego death. That's when the paticca-samuppada, you know, feeling, craving, grasping, becoming, has been suspended and no birth arises. That means it lapses into a moment where the sense of I isn't born for a moment or two, and that's the experience of the, you know, the anatta. But then of course it starts again because of the weakness of our wisdom. But anyway, that's, you know, that's death. And then you're born again, but you're born again as an Arya, you know, with the noble wisdom, or at least on the first path of, you know, the stream entry. And then of course with the, as you go on, and the practice is the same. The practice of the Sotapanna, striving for once returning, is the same as what he had practiced before, the same type of, but now it's easier to get a hold of, because you know the process, you know how it works. And so it's much easier to get that experience again and again. And therefore you go through the other stages as well. Of course, all the other factors of the Eightfold Path, Sila, Samadhi, and Panya, have to be, you know, integrated in balance also with it. That's actually what allows that process to continue at a steady kind of pace. So the, you know, when a person attains arahantship, it's like, you know, that I gets killed forever. The sense of I, the last bit of mana, gets severed and broken with the path of arahantship. And that's the permanent death of avidya. That's the permanent death of the ego. And that's real death. Because at that moment, paticca-samuppada stops permanently. Even though the person goes on living, there's no more ignorance. And, you know, suffering arises by clinging to the aggregates, including the aggregate of consciousness, but now there's no more clinging to them. And so, basically, death is also stopped. Birth and death stops, you know, with the attainment of the arahantship. And that is a real death. The death of the physical body means nothing to an arahant or the Buddha. Just like throwing away, you know, some dirty smelly clothes. Not to put them on anymore. And so, an arahant, sort of, to use the expression, they die before they die. It means they've already died to ignorance. They've died to the ego, and all of its tyranny, in its greed, hatred, and delusion, and sent Mara packing. So they, you know, for the most part, the Buddha has already, as the ego consciousness has died. So you don't say the Buddha died. You know, the term they use for the Buddha and Arahants, when their body is cremated or when it passes away, they say parinibbana. It means full and complete nibbana. They don't say death. And the reason why is they don't really die in the ordinary sense, because from the Aryan Dhamma point of view, real death is ego death. The death of these physical bodies from life to life is just like changing a set of clothes, that's all. Because the mind keeps on going. And the mind doesn't die. Only different experiences change. So you might change from a human experience to a Deva experience. You change from a Deva experience to a ghost experience. And so on. So that's the way that we, you know, should try to really understand the Paticca-samuppada. In order to understand these meanings about how the, you know, the Buddha doesn't really die. Or the phrase, my favorite phrase, Dhammapada phrase, is the, you know, the one I recited this morning. You know, appamado amata padam, pamado matino padam. That means the mindfulness is the path to the deathless. Unmindfulness is the path to death. The mindful do not die, and the unmindful are as if dead already. So to understand, you know, if you say that phrase to, you know, somebody in front of Walmart or some ordinary person, and what, you scratch their head and they say, walk away. So they wouldn't understand. It's the mindful do not die. That means the enlightened person doesn't die, and the unmindful are as if dead already, because basically they're still dying every moment. But the enlightened one consciousness doesn't die; it attains illumination, and you know, awareness is constantly and permanently glowing. That's why Arahants, the Buddhas, or even people who attain higher stages, they don't sleep much. And when they sleep, especially a Buddha or Arahant, they don't really sleep like the ordinary person. Their awareness is still glowing, only their physical systems have calmed down, their sankharas have kind of subsided. But awareness is still there all the time. So that's the meaning of they don't die. You die when you lose consciousness. And that's why, you know, for a meditator, what we've been mentioning several times, you know, preparing for the time of death, that you prepare for death by learning to remain conscious. To remain conscious even of the death process. Because, you know, as you're laying there in, you know, on the deathbed, there's different types of death. The best way to die would be to die of natural old age causes, or at least a sickness that goes on for several months or even years, because then you have a long time to prepare. But sudden deaths are much worse, because it doesn't give you any time. And especially if you haven't prepared, it doesn't give you any time at all. So the worst type of deaths are the accidental deaths. And only somebody like an anagami or once returner or anagami could probably handle accidental death and remain totally conscious at that time. Whereas other people, they can train themselves. But again, death can happen at any time. We don't know the time, a place, a situation. So that's why in our regular daily practice of meditation, we're trying to cultivate this awareness. So that to stay awake in meditation and not to keep falling asleep, every time you fall asleep, it's like a death. Your consciousness has died, it's lost its light. And so just to remain awake, even though you might have lots of thoughts going through your mind, maybe you're not very well concentrated, but just the fact that you're awake and you're not losing your consciousness and you're not getting totally lost in thoughts, that itself is good. And to have that awareness of, not to move and itch and rub and so on. Every time you itch and rub and consciously move, it's like you're doing bhava again, becoming. And then the ego is re-strengthening. Because I got rid of that itch. I got rid of that unpleasant feeling. So every time you move, give in to various unpleasant feelings and sensations, or give in to your emotions, and start getting angry and accusing people and this and that, then that strengthens, of course, the bhava, and then the jati happens. The ego is born even in a stronger way in the next moment. And so that's the way that we have to try to, when we practice, especially for, practicing vipassana meditation, once you've gotten through the initial stages, then that really becomes the nitty-gritty of that observation and the wisdom, generating the wisdom. So anyway, just want to mention that about the there's two types of death: the death of the body and the death of the ego consciousness. And so that's really what we can sort of observe and manage in our meditation. Because we can't really control our body. It has its own, sort of karmic energies and lifespan according to karma. But in cultivating mindfulness, concentration and wisdom, then we can, prepare ourselves. So if you remain conscious at the time of death, if you're here and now, if you train yourself to live here and now in the present moment without too much grasping and so on, and even if you're laying on your bed and sick, if you're going through some sickness and illness, even though people think that's bad, actually that's good. You have all this time to lay in bed. When else can you do that? Right? So, but you have to muster up the energy to focus on the body and see it as, this is not my body. This body is not me. Not myself. Not mine. And exert all of your effort and bring all of your effort to bear on that, on the painful feelings or just any fear of death and so on. And just to, make that your absolute number one. Forget about the breath and anything else. Just make that, your absolute point of object of concentration. Until it becomes cemented kind of in one's consciousness. So that when the moment of death comes, you'll be remaining consciousness. That's why actually being drugged, even though certain types of deaths are very painful and people can't bear up the pain, so doctors are always wanting to feed them drugs, of course, because the average person has no tolerance for pain. But for a Buddhist, for a practicing Buddhist, in your life you can make pain the focus of one's attention when it comes. And so by learning how to sit through the pains of sitting for, an hour or two or more in meditation, various types of pains, but knowing their impermanence, being able to just sit through and relax, knowing this is not me, not mine, not myself, it's impermanent, and just remain fixed on the earth element or the breathing or whatever your object is, or just not me, not mine, not myself. Even if that was just a continuous mantra replaying over in your mind over and over like a broken record, that would have a powerful effect. So, if you can withstand the pains in this life, or next time you get some minor sickness or a headache, try not taking an aspirin. And just use that as a challenge to see if you can actually do that, to muster up the wisdom to be able to sit through those pains, because none of those pains are going to kill you. But they're painful, but knowing that it's the mind that magnifies that. So you use that as a challenge. And when you can do that little by little, when next time you go to a dentist, don't take Novocaine. And just sit there in the chair and take that as a challenge to feel all the sensations of drilling and so on, whizzing through the nervous system and so on. And I know it works. I would do it myself. And, but this is the challenge. This is the work. This is the warriorship. We're in this fight. Fight for our life. It takes a warrior, to hunt down Mara. Come on, Mara. Boom. Knock out punch. That's the challenge of meditation. And even though the lay people, they all have excuses. Well, I'm just a little layman. I can't do that. That's baloney. You can do it. If you want to. See, but Mara's got you. Making excuses. Because there's many lay people who attain the stages, at least the stages of Sotapanna, once returning and even never returning. But anyway, so now coming back to the daily life and the integration of Sila, Samadhi and Panya, the Noble Eightfold Path, to connect it to the steps of the dependent origination. I started to mention that yesterday. So, we practice Sila. You all know what that is, of course. Sila is like, because in the beginning we're trained, so we have these habits of telling lies and maybe killing insects or using rough speech and whatever, following our passion. But then you take the precept and you consciously start practicing the Dhamma, then it's a hard training, because these habits are very strong, because everyone around you is doing it, or at least many people and the normal people. It's very difficult not to do it. And if you don't tell lies and do this and that, sometimes it's hard to keep your job, right? Because your boss expects you to tell some white lie or look the other way, or when they're changing the books, or whatever. So it's a challenge. So anyway, we take the Sila. Sila is like a policeman in your mind. That when you're about to do something, then you see that policeman in the mind and, oh, be a good little boy. But when the policeman is not there, then you just go run amok. Like at the traffic lights, right? When the policeman is physically there directing traffic, like this, everybody obeys the laws. Slows down. Where the cop is driving on the highway, everybody makes the same speed. And as soon as they turn off on the connector, the expressway speeds up. When the policeman leaves the intersection, then everybody's starting to jostle for position and so on. So it's the same way. If we don't have Sila, then Mara and our habits of greed, hatred and delusion just follow their own course. So the sila is like a policeman. That's why when you observe sila, remind yourself of the precepts every day. Then when you're about to do something, that comes up. But I gave the example yesterday that let's say you have mosquitoes biting you, and you know you have that urge to scratch, and your arm moves up, and at the last minute you remember, you force yourself to put the hand down. But you still wanted to kill it. You would have liked to kill it, but because of the policeman is there, and the fear of, you know, some bad karma, you stopped it. So at least that much is good. So practicing the silas is kind of an enforced behavior. It doesn't change your mind very much. The desires are still there in the mind, but somehow you force yourself because of the fear of bad karma and the, you know, the fear of like rebirth in bad places is part of it. Or you somehow try to do that. But many oftentimes you break it because your mindfulness is weak. That's why sila in itself normally isn't very effective unless you also meditate. But sila prevents the bhava. This is where I connect it to the paticca-samuppada, that bhava or becoming is prevented by sila. Even though you might go through craving and grasping, thinking, and then coming to a decision, but the last minute, you know, the policeman comes up and stops you from breaking the precept. Well, it's about ready to tell a lie, or you know, any number of things. Go after somebody else's, you know, husband or wife or so on. Or take a drink, intoxicate the mind. So it's that fear, you know, hiri and otapa. The fear of dread of the consequences and the scrupulousness. These are sort of the protectors of the mind. And so, you know, to really think of the consequences of what you're going to do in terms of breaking the precepts. Because again, it's a habit. Once you do it, it becomes easier to do it again and again and again. And you may not experience some direct result the first time of doing some negative karma, but if you let it go as a habit, it builds up, and then it causes you know, some heavy types of suffering. There's a little jingle, as some of you probably heard me say this before, a good explanation of karma. You sow a thought, reap an action. That means if you go on thinking about something, sooner or later you're going to act upon it. Like thinking about to tell that lie and, you know, see other people getting away with it. Okay, I'll do it. So, and then you sow an action and you reap a habit. Once you get away with it once or twice, you think, this is easy. Yeah, easy street. So it becomes a habit. You think you're going to get away with it again and again. And then you sow the habit. That means it becomes, you know, you do it more and more and in bigger and more dangerous situations. And then so you sow the habit and you reap a character. That means people are going to now call you by how you act. That person's a chronic liar, they're a chronic thief, they're an alcoholic, they're a philanderer, or whatever, you know, any number of terms that are given to people. You know, that becomes your character. People identify, a drunkard, or you know, something. Wife beater. So, and then you sow the character and then reap a destiny. And the destiny could be prison, somebody coming after you with a knife or a gun, or the next life. You know, some rebirth. So sooner or later it will get you. So anyway, that is the somehow come of snowballs. And that's why it's best to catch these things in the beginning, because once they become a habit, it's much harder to stop these things. That's why in meditation, the sooner you can see a thought or emotion arising, to have the mindfulness on it immediately, then it's still kind of weak. It's like an octopus. You know, octopus in the ocean with 8 tentacles. So if he gets one tentacle on you like that, you can still kind of fairly easy, you know, get it off. So if we notice a negative thought come into our mind at the very first signal, it can just drop away quickly. But if it gets 2 on you, if you're a little bit slow, and it gets 2 on you, it's a little bit more difficult to get it off, but still you can. Then it gets 3 on you, and 4 on you. The more it gets on you, the more difficult it is to get to free the mind from that. That means whatever urge it is, whatever thought, and so on. And, you know, then it gets 6 or 7 or 8 on you, then, you know, then you're going to create bhava. You know, you're going to do some action based on it, because you can't get away from it. So that's why, you know, mindfulness is really the most important mental factor of all of them, especially to be able to observe our intentions and thoughts. So, anyway, so the precept, sila, is connected with the bhava. But then, as I mentioned, the precepts alone are not going to be effective very long, because there's still the strong desires in the mind. Practicing sila doesn't necessarily weaken the desires in the mind. It can help a little bit, but it's not a guarantee. So this is where the samadhi, that means meditation, right effort, right mindfulness and right concentration, they act against grasping, because grasping is the continued thoughts in our mind. So by practicing concentration and mindfulness, by observing our thoughts, we can overcome the hindrances, and gradually those thoughts will subside down and our mind becomes quiet. And when the mind becomes peaceful and quiet, then it becomes happy. And there's no any thought in your mind to break any kind of precept. That'd be the furthest thing from your mind ever, would be to want to break any precept, because the mind doesn't even want to move. It's just, you know, so tranquil and calm that it's content forever. I mean, it could be. But so when you practice the samadhi, that prevents or reduces the grasping. That means the neurotic thoughts and planning and scheming, when you, you know, remain in a peaceful state of mind and you're more content with the present moment. But as you all know, samadhi by itself also is not the end of meditation. It's called temporary peaceful abiding, you know, for temporary time. When you come out of only samadhi practice, slowly the mind starts reverting back to its normal habits and fast pace and so on. And you could again then become unmindful and break the precepts again. And so this is where the panya plays its important role. And panya works on the craving. So grasping comes because there's the craving there. But samadhi alone can't reach the craving, because it's deeper roots. So that's where the panya. Panya means the path knowledge. It means the knowledge of anicca, dukkha, anatta, and especially attaining magga, path knowledge, sotapanna path, once returning path, never returning path, arahant path. The fetters are cut. Like with the Sotapanna path, we cut Sakkaya Ditti, Vichikicca, Silabhata Paramasa. Those three lower fetters. And it cuts them permanently. Although up to the Sotapanna stage, craving and aversion have not really been cut. Although they would probably be weaker than when you were before, but still active. So it only takes the once returning stage to seriously weaken greed, the root of greed and aversion, which means the initial, the craving. But it's only that wisdom that weakens the craving. And then when you attain the anagami stage, then the desire and aversion is totally eliminated. But it's the wisdom that reduces or eliminates craving. The samadhi weakens grasping, and the sila is what, you know, prevents the bhava. Although normally they're kind of reversed. In the paticca samuppada, craving comes first, then grasping, then bhava. But in actual practice, sila comes first, then samadhi, and then panya. Not really in that order, but actually panya should be first. You know, in the Noble Eightfold Path, samadhiti, samasankapu, that's panya. Then why do you say sila, samadhi, and panya? It should be panya, samadhi, or panya, sila, samadhi. To be, you know, more kind of accurate. Some sort of, this is where the three levels of wisdom come into play. We start with Sutramaya Panya. You read some sutras, you get, get interested in practice. You haven't meditated yet, but at least you have some Sutramaya Panya that awakens your faith to want to practice. So then, what do you practice? You start practicing sila. Because that's probably the easiest for most people. But as you're practicing sila, you realize that you keep on breaking them because you're not concentrating. So then you want to start practicing concentration. As you practice concentration, and get more calm, then you're able to practice sila a little bit better. And then you start gaining wisdom into the nature of kamma, the nature of the mind. And that increases your faith. Every time you get a little more wisdom, you get more faith. Wow. And that increases your wisdom, sila better. And then that in turn deepens the concentration. And that in turn deepens the wisdom. And then they keep on going like that. So, you know, that is the way that, you know, those, I just wanted to kind of make that comparison between sila, samadhi, and panya, and how they directly work on the paticca samuppada and those three levels. I mean, that's just a general kind of description, but it kind of works like that. Because we can't, it's not easy to get our, control our mind. The body is easier to control. Even though the source of suffering is in our mind, because we can't reach it easily, that's why normally sila comes first. And then the samadhi and then the panya. But depending on people's past life experience and so on, and the amount of their accumulated understanding, some people are more sharp with panya. Panya arises more easily and strongly in some people. In other people, they might have more samadhi, might be more powerful. And other people might be more naturally inclined to sila. I mean, there are people like that. You know, you don't even have, not religious, but they just naturally are very, you know, mild-mannered people and don't really break many precepts. but they may not have any concentration or wisdom. So there's, you know, every individual is different in terms of what levels of past life experience they have with them. Those levels of Sila, Samadhi, and Panya. Now I want to spend the last few minutes talking about how to really integrate the meditation in the daily life. As you all, you know, you're all lay people and you're always saying, well, you know, when I go to retreat, you know, I can kind of do the meditation, I can sit for an hour and it's really easy because we're in a group. When I go home, you know, I try to sit by myself, and after 10 minutes I start getting restless and, you know, forgot to feed the dog and the cat and, you know, this and that. And so you're some other distractions. Oh, I can't meditate. Anyway, Mara makes you get up. or you're just, you know, somebody was just telling me, you know, they have so many things to do during the day, they can't move slowly and mindfully, so they have to hurry up for a short period of time and do something, you know, quickly. And sure, there might be times when we have to do that. And we may lose our mindfulness, but usually those rushing around, there's always a minute or two or a few minutes here and there in between our rushing around that we could stop and pause. But because of the habit, even though we have a couple minutes when we could stop and pause, Mara takes over our mind and we waste our time by looking around, you know, kind of, you know, don't know how to control our mind. You know, we've never practiced standing meditation, for example. If you haven't taught standing meditation, you're standing around, you don't know how to meditate. You know, well, that lady's hair, what, you know, that, her hairstyle, is that enough? So good? You know, what kind of shoes are those? We allow our mind to, you know, just get to waste our time in comparisons and judgments and so on. Because we haven't trained ourselves. So, you know, we've created, you know, most of you have heard this explanation before about minute meditations. So people that are always having difficulty to say they don't have no time to meditate because they think meditation is sort of an hour or nothing. You know, if they can't sit for an hour, they think it's no use or something, or half an hour. So the practice of M&Ms, I call it M&M. That stands for a minute meditation, or a minute of mindfulness, but a minute meditation is good. That means you train yourself to stop every hour for 1 minute. Because at least once an hour, almost anybody could find time to pause and stop for 1 minute. Now if I asked you to stop for 10 minutes, 10 minutes, no, I'll have to pick up my buddha. but you know, one, can you stop for 1 minute? 1 minute? You'd have to, you look kind of foolish thinking you can't stop for just 1 minute, right? Because we waste so much, we waste so much time in between. So it's kind of psychological. So anyway, you train yourself, whatever it is, a stopwatch or every hour on the hour. Or sometimes you can't do that exactly, it doesn't really matter, but in between major changes of activities, after, you know, after preparing your food, putting it in the oven, before turning around to rush to do the dishes, just stop. And you close the oven door, put the pot on the stove, and just stop. And just let go of the future. Just bring your mind to the body, take a deep, slow breath. Just kind of tell yourself, breathing in, letting go of the past and future, breathing out, standing here and now. And just do that a few times, and you can kind of, the mind and body can kind of just relax and settle back into the present moment. Or, if your mind is holding on to some anger or some other types of negative states, you can kind of reflect on that. You could do a minute of metta. Breathing in, May all beings be well and happy, free from suffering. Breathing out, may all beings be well and happy, free from suffering. May I be well and happy, free from suffering on the in-breath, on the out-breath. May all beings be well and happy, free from suffering. And even just doing that two or three times can calm you down. The main thing is it calms you down. It kind of helps the mind kind of settle back to the present moment and kind of get an edge over its nervous system. And just, you know, to relax a bit. And then you start doing whatever you have to do again. But then you try to do that, like every hour. So in that minute, you can release the stress of the previous hour. Whatever neurotic stress or worry you had, you just temporarily let that go and just focus on the breathing or just the body sensations. And just tell yourself, standing, 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 standing. That's very, very effective. And so if you can do that all day long, every hour, by the end of the day, you have 12 minutes of good meditation. Because anybody can stay focused for 1 minute. It's not really that difficult. And so at least you get a quality 1 minute of mindfulness. Whereas if you meditate for 30 minutes in the morning, if you're honest, most people are lucky if 5 minutes out of 30 you could actually, you would have been concentrated or focused, because your mind will go in and out of drowsiness or wandering thoughts, worrying about the day ahead, and so on. So these 1 minute meditations, even though they're short, you repeat it over and over. So it becomes a habit. It becomes a good sankara. And it can catch you before you've maybe then done something negative. By learning how to stop and pause, before you're about to do something, you have a brief couple seconds to contemplate it or see that urge and be able to kind of back off and not do maybe it was an urge to want to tell a lie or tell somebody's secrets or something, and you can reflect, I better not do that, and let go of it. So those pauses help you to do that. So, like that, especially, that's why I've been encouraging you, whenever you stand up, even out of meditation, before, if I say stand up, people normally will stand up quickly and they'll immediately start moving to do something. But the transition from sitting to walking, they forget that. Standing is the transition zone from inactivity to activity. And so we've been inactive by sitting down or laying down or sleeping, wake up, I'm just late, boom! Jump up and wow! Then trip over something on the ground. Then injure your arm and have to spend a lot of time fixing it, and you get late. So in this name of, I don't have enough time, I have to rush, so many times we make mistakes, accidents. We have to clean up and then waste our time. But instead, if you learn to manage your time a little bit more, kind of spread it out, and this also helps with the idea about the renunciation, learning how to simplify the life and eliminate some of the unnecessary, useless habits you have that hope will give you a little bit more free time. So that you can move a little bit more mindfully, more of the time, be able to maintain a more even a vibration in the nervous system. And so, people have to manage their time. But it's because of being unmindful that you don't know how to manage the time, and you get carried away with useless things, and oh my God, the time's gone already. I'm late for the airport. Oh. And you go to the airport, passport, passport. Oh my God, I left my passport. I've done that myself. Or probably the most common one, you're coming home from work, you have 20 minutes to take a shower and get to the temple or something, or some other meeting. Drive in your driveway, and get out of the cars, close the door, going to rush into the house. You put down your wallet or keys somewhere, and you run into the shower, take your shower, and you're getting dressed. And so, ya todo, cogido. Forgot the keys. Didn't know where you put the keys. See, you panic, and then you spend 10 minutes trying to find the keys, and then you get late. But instead, had you taken one extra minute, just one extra minute, to move a little bit more slowly, into the house, and then mindfully, really be aware of where you're putting the keys, and really, getting a good visual of this key is going down on this chair next to that table, and kind of like a photograph, Because the mind remembers like that, and it's like a photographic memory. But if you're clear on it, that means you're mindfully, the intention has to be there. Normally we're unmindful, we kind of put it down and just vaguely aware of what it was because our mind is in the future. So we're doing something in the present there, but the mind is mostly in the future. We don't see that. And that's why you forget. And then you have to spend more time trying to remember it. You wind up being late anyway. So, mindfulness has many important benefits. It's like a miracle cure for many, many things. But again, it takes effort. And the right effort to the Eightfold Path. It's probably one of the hardest of the Eightfold Path to cultivate, right effort, because the mind's so lazy. So the effort to prevent negative states from coming in. But if you don't meditate, it'll be impossible to prevent negative states coming into your mind. So then the backup is, once they've gotten into the mind, to push them out of the mind. But then it's harder, of course. And that's where you have to muster up more effort and wisdom to force that negative thought out of the mind. And then to cultivate the wholesome thoughts. The effort to, and the best effort would be the effort to find time to meditate every day. The effort to get up 20 minutes, 30 minutes earlier every day in the morning. Because the time you spend 30 minutes meditating in the morning is going to be better than even an hour of extra sleep. Or certainly more better than just an extra 30 minutes of sleep. But these, of course, are things that you have to, and that's the meaning of effort. It takes effort. But nothing is acquired without the effort. And effort is part of samadhi. It means concentration, being concentrated on what you want to do. So cultivating those minutes of mindfulness, that's really the practice of Dhamma. Because if you can't even do that much, there's not much hope that you're going to be able to make much progress in developing a more continuous level of mindfulness. Because even if you practice meditation once a day only, or let's say, when you go on a retreat, like you've come here, you spend probably about almost 4 hours every day, meditating, sitting and meditating, or standing and walking. And so you go home and think, I'm going to meditate twice a day, in the morning and evening. Maybe you do the first couple of days. Things start crowding in, and then you give up the evening meditation. You're too tired after work. Then you can do the morning meditation. Maybe you do it for 30 minutes, two or three times. Then slowly that 30 minutes drops down to 20. Then a few more days, 20 drops down to 10. And then before you know it, you're drinking down the last of the tewatura and go out and pat the Buddha on the head and say, Namo Buddhaya, you meditate for me. Buddha, meditate for me. And that's all your meditation. So many people find themselves in that dilemma. So especially if you find yourself like that, then these minute meditations are, you know, the second best, or even better. Because I think actually those, you know, if you do those minute meditations regularly, make the effort to do it, you'll find that that actually has more value and benefit in your daily life than just forcing yourself to sit for a longer time once in a while, or just on the night when there's meditation at the pansala or something like that, or just when the retreats come around. Although those things are equally as good, but the minute meditations helps to provide a continuity throughout the days, which is important, because again, the surprises come there out there on, in the daily life. It's a surprise, not when you're sitting in meditation so much, but out there in the daily life, when you're at your work, you get a phone call from the doctor saying that he's found a positive, you know, pap smear test or something, or you know, your child is in a police station, any number of things. You know, when you start panicking, and then that's when you start becoming unmindful, when you start sort of panicking and rushing about. So, you know, those are really good things to practice. So that's why every time you stand up, that's really the best time to do it. Because you know, when you're standing up, either from meditating or anything else, or sitting down, before rushing off to the next thing, just you know, stand up straight, take a couple of deep breaths, just sort of relax. It's not a big deal. But you know, you break that neurotic push into the future. One of my favorite phrases is, you know, the neurotic push into the future. I mean, there's always some, like there's somebody behind us always pushing. We're kind of just racing from one thing to another. You know, not really clear and relaxed in our mind. And that's when we make mistakes. That's when we become unmindful and we get caught up in our anger or aversion or attachments and so on. So, you know, that's all Dhamma practice. Not just doing pujas and collecting merit. Even though that may be useful, but and that may help us, of course, to you know, meditate, but you know, that's really going to be more useful than just collecting merit. Because again, merit can help you get reborn in heaven and so on. But it's being mindful at the time of death and having wisdom at the time of death that's going to prevent you from, cut the cycle of rebirths altogether. Or at least to help have a much better quality type of birth. So, these are just things I wanted to share with you and encourage you in the practice. And so we're going to have another questions and answers session a little bit later. So, any final questions that you may have on any of the things that we talked about, then you can write them down. So, so for now, just try to let all of that excitement go and just sort of sit up a little straight and do an M&M just right now, just sitting, just take a deep, slow breath, a couple deep, slow breaths, just let the mind gradually come back to feel the body sitting, just breathing in, letting go of the past and future, and breathing out. sitting here and now.